This financial year, Australia will spend more than $370 million delivering aid and development projects in Indonesia. That money is used to do things like train teachers and nurses, provide clean water, and build schools and infrastructure. To make these projects happen, a large number of aid and development workers travel to Indonesia, either on short-term contracts or more permanently. The United Nations says there are around 10,000 Australians living in Indonesia. Often called expatriates or expats, Australian staff and consultants work alongside their Indonesian counterparts. But although they may do the same work, Australian and other international staff are usually paid a lot more than their Indonesian colleagues.
So we are at the same level as a program officer, but he got more than me.
Did you think that was fair?
That was not fair, of course.
You're hearing from Franz. He's an Indonesian geographer with a master's degree in political science. A few years ago, Franz moved with his family to Indonesia's capital city, Jakarta, to work for a United Nations project. The project aimed to tackle illegal logging, which is a big problem in Indonesia. But as Franz became aware of differences in pay between him and his international colleagues, he felt increasingly unhappy.
But something struck me about the, you know, unfairness in wage between me and my other colleague, especially with the manager. I don't know, because maybe he's not Indonesian, right? I'm a local officer, I'm local staff, and he's like someone assigned from headquarters.
There's nothing unusual about a manager being paid more than project officers. But what stands out here is how big the difference was.
Our wage, like, you know, sky and ground.
The right? Difference between...
Right, the difference, yeah. At the time, I just got $1,300.
Per month.
But my boss, almost 15,000 per month.
On these numbers, Franz's salary works out to around $18,000 per year. While that is a fairly high salary by Indonesian standards, it looks very small next to his manager's $200,000. But Franz's situation is not unique. In fact, this is how things work in the aid and development sector all over the world. Local staff are paid at local rates, while their international colleagues receive many times more. Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world, and Jakarta is its biggest city. Home to more than 10 million people, Jakarta is loud, crowded, and hot. It's also a place of contradictions. In the city centre, makeshift slums rub up against luxury apartment towers, and children beg for coins outside some of the glitziest shopping malls you're ever likely to see. This reflects what's happening across Indonesia more broadly. Although the country has recorded many years of economic growth, inequality is widening. To put it simply, the rich are getting richer, while almost half the population still live on less than $2 a day. Against this backdrop, expatriates in Jakarta have much more in common with the city's wealthy elite than with the average Indonesian.
I'm Megan and I'm from the US and I've lived in Jakarta for just over 3 years.
Like Franz, Megan moved to Jakarta to work in the aid and development sector. But while Franz lives in an outer suburb more than an hour from his office, Megan has recently moved into an exclusive apartment complex in Jakarta's central business district.
What makes it, I guess, a fancy apartment? What about it?
Well, just that level of service of the gym in the building and the pool in the building, and there's like a club room in the building. You can order in room service and the cleaning service, and it's a luxury sort of setting.
Although it sits a little uncomfortably for Megan, this type of apartment complex is standard fare for an expat aid worker in Jakarta. Complexes are usually surrounded by walls or high fences, with teams of security checking every car and visitor at the gates. Often they're so well equipped that residents barely need to leave. They have their own pools, gyms and children's playgrounds, and there are cafes, bars and supermarkets all within their walls. For Megan, as for many residents, that self-containment is part of the appeal.
Another kind of secondary choice to where I'm living is that I do have a gym in the building. I tried to join a gym, and you know, an outside gym, and I just never went because to get there was just such a hassle.
It's not that Megan hates Jakarta. It's just that Jakarta can be a very difficult place to get around.
Traffic is really, really impactful on your life. I mean, you know, you plan social life. I mean, you don't want to take a risk on going out for something that might not be fun because you're going to spend an hour getting there and spend an hour getting back, even if it's really close by.
Megan's not exaggerating. Jakarta's roads are famous for their chaos and congestion, and parts of the city are in near constant gridlock.
I'm living where I'm living 100% because I can walk to work, and I would absolutely not live here otherwise.
But in the inner city, living in walking distance to work is a privilege most locals could only dream of. In the crowded heart of Jakarta, space is at a premium and real estate is expensive. Take The Peak, for example. That's the apartment complex where the Australian Embassy houses many of its Australian staff. A standard apartment at The Peak costs around $3,000 per month. With the average monthly wage in Indonesia at around $150, living somewhere like The Peak just isn't an option for most. Megan is aware of the privilege of her position, and it's something she's had to get used to.
I always kind of look down on the expats, quote unquote, you know, sort of up until this gig and coming here to Indonesia to be one, to be, you know, international development consultant or whatever.
And so did that take some getting used to? Are you used to it now?
I think I am used to it. I mean, I still have my moments where I'm like, this is ridiculous, you know, where I'm the building does some cleaning service, but I don't have anyone helping me cook. And I had a moment of almost panic about it, which I realized was a bad sign. You know, like, no, you can cut up your own cantaloupe. You can handle that. You have done it your whole life. So yeah, definitely quite used to it. And then I have my moments where I have to kind of laugh and try to take myself down a notch or two.
But while expatriates like Megan might not always feel comfortable about their lifestyles, France says expats don't talk about things like the wage gap with their Indonesian colleagues.
So do you think that expatriate staff realise that this is a problem?
They realise that, but they just keep it silent, you know. They don't want to raise that issue because they enjoy that, I think. They enjoy it. And I never find someone, expatriate, who, you know, wants to discuss it. Never.
As I researched this program, I spoke to a number of expatriates, and when I explained the topic, most were quick to tell me why the wage gap was not an issue. They said local staff generally understand that there are reasons for the wage gap and that they're okay with it. Others acknowledged that the wage gap was problematic, but couldn't see another way to do things. Chris Roach is an associate professor at La Trobe University's Institute for Human Security and Social Change. Before joining the university, he spent more than 25 years working for international aid organisations, which are often referred to as NGOs. He says it's difficult for international NGOs to address the wage gap.
If local staff were paid more or were paid at levels equivalent to expatriate staff, that would have several effects. Arguably, it would have an effect of hollowing out local organisations, local NGOs and the rest of it as staff move to better paid positions in international NGOs. And we've already seen this with government staff joining international NGOs because the pay is better than in some NGOs than in government. So there's a problem there. The second issue is the inequality that it potentially sets up between local staff and local organisations and local people.
The flip side, of course, is the situation we're seeing now.
The other side of the equation is the inequality between expatriate staff and local staff in organisations that sets up a hierarchy, a perceived form of discrimination, stroke racism, that is highly problematic. So I don't think there's an easy answer to this one. And I think the better NGOs have a real debate about this, because it is a debate, and they involve local staff in that debate.
Tulsi Narayanasamy also thinks it's time to start that debate. At the time of recording, Ms. Narayanasamy was the director of AidWatch, an Australian organisation that monitors aid and trade policy. AidWatch is a vocal critic of how aid work can affect local communities, and Ms. Narayanasamy says the aid sector has been reluctant to acknowledge the wage gap issue.
I think it's presumed that within the sector, because people are working towards, you know, equality and justice, that, you know, that isn't something that needs to be paid attention to, I suppose.
Ms. Narayanasamy believes it's time for the aid sector to address its own role in promoting inequality.
Aid really needs to be seen as one of those systems that does perpetuate inequality oftentimes. The fact that we would be happy for those sorts of situations to take place where people are being paid less, largely because of where they happen to come from, it's a huge problem.
A team of researchers from New Zealand felt the same way, and a few years ago they began to investigate the wage gap issue.
It was a study across six countries. So we had in Oceania, we had Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands, we had emerging economies, India and China, and we had Uganda and Malawi as landlocked economies in sub-Saharan Africa.
Stuart Carr is a professor of psychology at New Zealand's Massey University. Between 2007 and 2010, he led a study called ADDUP, which stands for Are Development Discrepancies Undermining Performance? Professor Carr and his colleagues wanted to find out how big the pay gap actually was and how it affects aid workers in their jobs. Over 3 years, the ADDUP team spoke with local and expatriate aid workers in six developing countries.
So six country, three kind of regions, if you like. It was multi-sector. There were 1,300 people, 202 organisations.
The ADDUP research found that local workers were paid four times less on average than their international colleagues. In Pacific nations, the average climbed to nine times, and across the sample, there were many individual cases where the gap was much larger.
It is a bit of a concrete ceiling for a lot of local people. They can't break out of the that salary structure that they're in into that higher income bracket. So it is, it's quite a difficult problem actually.
As well as measuring the size of the gap, the ADDUP researchers wanted to know how local workers felt about it, and their findings were very clear.
The biggest thing, the standout finding, was that people felt, especially local people on local salaries, felt that it was very unfair and unjust. That was the big standout finding.
The ADDUP study did not include Indonesia, and there is very little data available about salaries in the aid sector there. But in Jakarta, Fran says the wage gap is alive and well.
When you are expatriate, you get more in terms of wage or insurance, other things. It's like a common here.
And like the local workers in the ADDUP study, Franz believes this situation is unjust.
My 11 years experience enough to get more. So I deserve more.
Franz says it's the size of the gap that bothers him the most.
When expatriates come and hold the same position as a manager, our wage gap is so huge. For Indonesian manager, only two or three times. But for expatriate manager, almost 10, even 20.
Concerns about the size of the gap stood out from the ADDUP findings too.
We had these in-country workshops, and every single workshop told us exactly the same thing. You need to close the gap.
So why is there such a big gap between local and international wages? Expatriates are quick to point out that there are costs involved in moving to a new country. They might also be paying mortgages and other costs back home, which would be hard to do on a local salary. Beyond the financial costs, international staff often make significant personal sacrifices for their work. Spending so much time away from friends and loved ones can be difficult. Relationships at home may suffer, and landing in a new place means starting all over again. Professor Carr says local workers are sympathetic to these issues and are generally happy to accept some level of wage disparity. But for many, the gap has simply gotten too wide.
People didn't say it has to be exactly the same amount of pay and benefits, because they did recognise that people, you know, relocating countries has added costs and so on. But what they said was the acceptable threshold was 2 to 3 times, you know, max local salary. But then, of course, we saw the average was 4. The only place where it didn't get to that level was in China. And in China, we found the least problems with the system.
Franz agrees that 2 or 3 times the local salary would be an acceptable difference.
Okay, let's say wage disparity makes sense, but not too huge. Let's say 2 or 3 times, that's fine, but not 10 times. I understand sometimes they bring their family here, they need more money to get international school, but 10 times it's too much, I think. I mean, it's not fair.
You may have noticed Franz mentioned international schools, which raises another disparity between locals and expats. International schools are private schools that cater to a wealthy market. Classes are taught in English, and the curriculum follows international rather than local standards. These are the schools where expats typically send their children, and the fees can be expensive. For many expatriates, though, they won't have to pay them out of pocket.
Quite often, it's the expatriate worker who gets most of the benefits. So it was the expats that had the 24-hour security, the electricity bills all paid, and the kids sent to private school.
Things like school fees often form part of a wider benefits package that comes with an expat salary. And this was another area where local staff felt disadvantaged.
The benefits and the money together, they kind of show the symbolic value that people have to the organisation, eh? I mean, when we look at our wages, we don't just see dollars, we see how much does the system value what I do here.
In Franz's case, his manager's benefits included extra annual leave.
I just got 12-day leave. He got 1 month leave. Right. And also other facility like insurance. My portion is too small. He got more. That was unfair, I think.
Those exclusive apartment complexes in Jakarta are also often included as part of an expat's salary package. For people in these situations, luxury living can come to seem like the norm, and Professor Carr thinks that might be part of the reason why the wage gap issue has had so little attention from the international community.
If you're mega rich, then you're not so tuned into the needs of others. You're desensitized, I think, a little bit. It's an idea that if you're high up in the pyramid, you can't really appreciate what it's like to be lower down. And so you get inured to other people's hardship.
The fact that expatriates are the ones who benefit from these inequalities may also be contributing to the silence.
There's a lot of vested interests in that system. Who's going to argue themselves out of a well-paid job with exotic travel and so on?
It may be surprising to think that a sector which is focused on reducing poverty and protecting human rights would be the site of such inequalities. Tulsi Narayanasamy thinks this contradiction makes it hard for the aid sector to do what it's supposed to do.
I think wage discrepancy is a great example of how it's absolutely impossible to realistically be challenging the root causes of injustice when that is an absolute injustice in and of itself.
But if the wage and benefits gap is such a widespread issue and local workers feel so unhappy about it, why aren't they speaking up? Professor Carr says there are legitimate reasons to keep quiet.
Those people that are on the lower salaries, they are often in a power relationship. They did our research surveys because they were anonymous, but I mean, you wouldn't speak out too loud if there was a chance of losing your job. So who's going to criticise the hand that feeds you, as it were?
The ADAPT team spoke to some local workers who said they had lost their jobs after they raised concerns about wages. And Fran says these fears make local workers feel powerless.
Do you think that a lot of Indonesian people working in the development sector,
yes,
feel angry or uncomfortable about this issue?
Sure. I know some are so frustrated with the situation, but in other hand, they also need money to feed their kids, you know, their family. So it's like no choice, something like that.
Cultural norms also come into play. In Indonesia, Franz says salary is such a taboo that instead of speaking out about it, most locals would prefer to simply quit their job and move on.
So you couldn't say, I feel unhappy because I don't feel that my wage reflects my work. You couldn't say that.
Never, never. You never say that with your boss. If you don't agree with the salary, you just quit and try, you know, apply another job.
In fact, that's exactly what Franz did do with his job at the UN.
I was so exhausted at the time, back and forth to Papua, you know, left your family at home, sometimes spend 2 weeks in remote areas. It's like a sacrifice for me, but I got a little. That was difficult at the time, and then I decided after discussing with my wife and, you know, my family, I decided to quit from that organization.
This is one way that the wage gap issue affects the broader workforce.
Whatever the reasons are for those differences in salaries, on the ground, people told us it makes life very difficult at work. So it undermined things like teamwork and so on. I think a big factor for local people was they said it was quite demotivating. It made them think about leaving the organisation and also leaving the country, which is brain drain by any other name.
In the aid world, when expats are brought into a country as consultants or advisors, this is known as technical assistance. The idea is that these consultants bring specialised skills or expertise that are not available in the host country. Over time, the technical assistance approach is supposed to build skills in the local market so that expats are no longer needed. But Tulsi Narayanasamy says it doesn't always work that way.
Basic development principles speak to the need for empowering local people and local communities, and oftentimes technical assistance can directly be taking away from that by bringing in highly skilled people from, for example, Australia, and basically playing that role of decision maker oftentimes, which, you know, seems to be deliberately ousting the capacity of local people to be able to engage within the development sector.
Chris Roach says the reliance on expatriate staff is partly a symptom of how much pressure aid programs and NGOs are now under.
The setting up of procedures, monitoring evaluation processes, reporting processes, the bureaucracy of aid management, if you like, has increased, I would say, dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years. And the effect of that is that large NGOs in particular need people with the kind of project management written skills to actually manage and report on programs. And I think that has had the effect, therefore, of increasing the numbers of expatriates in certain roles.
Although most donor countries do use technical assistance to deliver their aid programs, Australia relies on it far more than most. In 2009, the Australian National Audit Office reported that Australia spends about twice as much on technical assistance as other donor countries. The end result is that a large proportion of Australia's aid budget ends up back in Australian pockets.
You know, I think the other problem with technical assistance is, again, it's yet another opportunity for Australians to financially benefit. Often big contractors are the ones that win the tendering processes.
And AidWatch are not the only critics of technical assistance. The OECD has warned that by giving too much power and influence to expatriates, technical assistance can promote aid dependence in the long run. To add to these concerns, technical assistance is expensive. Under current Australian government guidelines, a senior aid consultant can be paid more than $21,000 a month. And that's before extras like travel and accommodation allowances. Using these figures, an Australian aid consultant could earn more in a month than their Indonesian colleagues do in a year. To get a feel for what a large aid project with lots of technical assistance looks like, I travelled to Central Kalimantan, where a controversial Australian project had just wrapped up. The Indonesian island of Kalimantan, or Borneo as it's also known, is the third largest island in the world. Famous for the orangutans that live in its vast jungles, Kalimantan has a big problem with deforestation. Most of its population live in small riverside villages, and many people make their living from the land. Often what that means is illegal logging and palm plantations. This has serious consequences not only for the local environment, but also for the region's carbon emissions. In June 2007, the Australian government announced a $30 million project to combat deforestation in central Kalimantan. Called the Kalimantan Forests and Climate Partnership, or KFCP, the project paid local people to protect and replant the region's forests. The idea was that this would help to stop illegal logging without taking away people's livelihoods. A project with as much money behind it as KFCP makes a big splash when it lands in a place like central Kalimantan. The region's population is small and spread out, and when KFCP arrived, it brought an influx of Australian and other consultants. The wage gap issue came with them.
Hello, my name is Annalisa. You can call me Anna. I am Director Executive Assistant. Actually, my role is for overseeing all the YTS programs.
Yeah, I'm Vita. I'm the Information Communication here in YTS. I'm especially responsible for the team, the Information and Communication team.
Anna and Vita work for an organisation called YTS, which has been running community development programs around central Kalimantan since 1997. Both women have been disappointed by their experiences working with expatriates.
Especially when we're really working hard and we know that many other people, they don't have to work that hard and they can get much, much higher salary and payment more than that. And I feel like, well, is this my fault or is this just the world's fault if this is how it works?
And though she keeps a sense of humour about it, for Vita, the wage gap is tied to broader issues like worth and respect.
Yeah, it's just discouraging, you know, that actually you have the same skill and capacities, but then you know that these persons are paid higher than you, respected more, valued more, and, you know, treated differently. Of course, it's discouraging.
And one of the biggest frustrations for Anna and Vita is that they feel powerless to change the situation.
It's like it's out of question when you say, like, why didn't I get the same payment as the expatriates even though we're at the equal level? And they will say, we have different standards. This is how it works in your world, in your country, and in our country it's different. You can't really argue beyond that.
So what do you feel about that?
I just feel that, well, I just feel it's a shame how underdeveloped is my country, so that we have such really low standard.
We don't have bargaining power.
Yeah, we don't have the bargaining power.
Because, like, then if we argue and then we know the result is, like, take it or leave it.
With a steady stream of Australian and other consultants pouring in to work on KFCP, these issues were magnified. Consultants were typically based out of central Kalimantan's capital, Palangka Raya, where they stayed in one of the city's most expensive hotels, sometimes for months at a time. An Indonesian woman who worked on KFCP told me that during that time, gossip in Palangka Raya ran hot. Local staff speculated about their colleagues' salaries and about how much of the project's budget was being spent in the hotel's nightclub. And in the remote areas where the project was delivered, villagers were also talking about the money.
They were not open about how much money was spent. I heard a number. A German guy told me the funding is so huge, 78 billion in total, he said. People heard that there is a lot of funding, $30 million. It was published on the internet and so on. Where does the money go?
Those voices are from the village of Mantangai Hulu, one of the sites where KFCP worked. With a local guide and translators, I travelled by speedboat to Mantangai Hulu and the nearby village of Katimpun to find out how the KFCP project had been received in the community. In Mantangai Hulu, the head of the village told us that KFCP had been deeply problematic. Village meetings about the project had ended in knife fights, death threats, and the vandalisation of the village hall. In fact, Mantangai Hulu was so divided by KFCP that some residents now want to split the village in two. The village head says the problems came from jealousy, because some households were paid by the project while others weren't. He feels the conflict was made worse by the amount of money involved.
Because of this, I feel discouraged. I have had enough of conflict. It's like the money is so much that it's worth fighting over.
Meanwhile, householders accused the village head and others of misusing KFCP funds and say they were afraid the project would take their land. Bahi is one of the householders who led opposition to the project, and he and his wife say they wanted assurance that they could keep some land to make a living from.
We are afraid of the final result. We are afraid there will be side effects and that people from outside will take over our land.
Bahi and his wife dispute the village head's version of events. But in Mantangai Hulu, the one thing both sides can agree on is that they're glad KFCP has gone.
I feel that since the project has stopped, we have peace. We are in peace here. We don't have conflict anymore or arguing it with each other.
The KFCP project was supposed to be a demonstration, which could be rolled out to other parts of Indonesia that have problems with deforestation. But that never happened. After a few years of operating, KFCP had fallen well behind its targets, and the Australian government eventually closed it down ahead of schedule. While many in Mantangai Hulu were relieved to see the project go, further up the river, the village of Katimpun was devastated.
When we held the farewell party at the village hall, a lot of people felt emotional. Some of them even shed tears. People hope that later on KFCP will continue, even under a new name, or someone else can come into this area and help us.
The village secretary told us KFCP was very popular there, and as we walked through Katimpun, we saw signs advertising the project on buildings and in people's yards. Householders learnt to grow kitchen gardens, a farming school was established, and rubber plantations were introduced to provide income for locals.
Before KFCP entered this area, it was really hard to find a job. Back then, we did illegal logging. When that was stopped, our income became uncertain and things did not improve. When KFCP entered this area in 2010, we learned how to plant rubber trees and other activities to improve our livelihood.
The village secretary told us that after KFCP suddenly shut down, the residents of Katimpun could not keep the farm school and other activities running. As livelihood options dwindled away, people began to leave the village in the hope of finding work elsewhere.
Now that KFCP is not here anymore, people must go away to earn a living. They don't stay in this village.
Anna and Vita believe KFCP demonstrates some of the problems of having development projects that are led by outsiders. They say that when projects are run by international agencies, English language skills become highly valued, while local knowledge and other important skills are overlooked.
The requirements is to find somebody who are able to speak English, right? But that's only for the sake of the director, so they can understand. So it's like bridging the gap. But actually, what you really need is more than just a language skill. You need the capacity building, you need the facilitation skills.
The KFCP project wanted to trial a form of carbon trading at the local level. But in central Kalimantan, where most people live in remote villages, concepts like carbon emissions and climate change are not widely understood. Anna and Vita say KFCP should have focused on helping the community to understand these concepts instead of trying to make big changes in a short time.
The core problem actually for me is because people at the lower level, they don't really understand what the program is all
yes,
about.
Yes, they don't know, they don't really understand about it. Yeah, what is this carbon is, what is climate change is.
Yeah,
this is a big project. There should be time to train them first. I mean, it's not just like 2-3 weeks trainings. We questions about that in that project. It seems like introducing amount of money to the people rather than development.
This brings us back to the issue of valuing local staff who know their communities and who are likely to be around long after the international consultants have left.
Expatriates are not gods. They don't know everything. In fact, like we, the local people, know more about our local context more than them. So they're not supposed to be the person who control us. We should take control of development.
But far from taking control, Anna and Vita feel local workers are not empowered in the development sector, while expats are seen as superior.
The intelligence is equal as us, but there's a difference in how we were treated.
They say that as well as receiving higher wages, expatriates are almost always in management positions, while locals play a support role.
There's a different standard for the Indonesian and the expatriates. They're always at the highest level.
Do you feel it would be easy to become the boss of an expat?
Oh, and it must be hard.
It's impossible. Almost impossible.
When local staff don't believe they could reach higher positions than expatriates, it's easy to see why organisations like the OECD are concerned about the impacts of technical assistance. Back in Jakarta, Franz agrees that expatriates can be overvalued. He says his former manager at the UN was a case in point.
He didn't understand at all about the substance of our work. He didn't understand about what is the problem with our illegal logging with the forest. Yeah, he just, you know, fluent in English. I wrote a report and then my boss edited and tried to fix my English. That's it.
Franz felt he had to make up for the skills his boss lacked, but without the extra salary or recognition.
I understand. He must not be, you know, understand about everything, right, at manager level. But for this project, he really rely on me for everything.
As with the KFCP project, Franz felt that a lack of local knowledge and leadership makes it hard to run effective development projects.
For a project like this, we need supporters, particularly from the government. If you cannot engage with the government...
The Indonesian government?
Right. You will fail to implement your project, since the beneficiary of this project is the government.
But if there was one place where these issues were starting to be addressed, it might have been the former AusAid post in Jakarta. Until recently, AusAid was the agency that managed and delivered Australia's aid program. AusAid had offices or posts in the countries where it worked, and these posts employed many local staff. Rivan Royono was one of them. An Indonesian development specialist, he worked at the AusAid post in Jakarta. Rivan says AusAid at that time was a good place to be as an Indonesian.
What I felt during my time with AusAid was it was a very egalitarian organization. There was a strong recognition on the importance of the local staff.
Although it was a government agency, AusAid operated with a level of autonomy. But when the Abbott government came to power, one of its first moves was to merge AusAid with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, or DFAT. This was part of a broader refocusing of Australia's aid program. Where its main aim had previously been to alleviate poverty, the Abbott government amended that aim to include promoting Australia's national interest. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop explained the change on the government's YouTube channel.
Together, the new development policy and performance framework represent a paradigm shift for Australia's aid program. This will build an aid program that both projects and protects Australia's interests while effectively promoting economic growth and development to reduce poverty and lift standards of living in our region.
The merging of AusAid and DFAT then was a way to focus Australia's aid more closely on what it could do for Australia. Before the merger, both AusAid and DFAT had a presence in Indonesia, but each played a different role. While AusAid was focused on delivering aid and development projects, DFAT's job was to improve trade and diplomatic relations with Indonesia. And on the ground, Rivan Royono says they were very different places to work.
AusAid made the decision a few years ago to recruit Indonesia's best and brightest. And so they made sure that the salary package was commensurate.
At AusAid, Indonesians held senior positions, and it was common for them to manage Australian staff. But in the Jakarta office of DFAT, things were different.
The former AusAid local staff were significantly more empowered. We led initiatives. We led mission teams. We were the ones who not only organized meetings, but actually the main representatives for AusAid in meetings with Indonesian government. With the former DFAT local staff, that was never their role. Their role was always supportive. They booked meetings. They were rarely, if ever, actually in the meeting. And when in meetings, they were usually note takers.
Rivan says that when AusAid and DFAT were merged, it was DFAT's culture that won out. Local staff were told they could be demoted and they could no longer manage Australian staff.
DFAT said that, you know, no local staff can manage Australian-based staff, which in AusAid culture, that just doesn't make sense. My team leader was an Indonesian, and she managed both local and Australian staff. And that was never a problem within AusAid.
Indonesians began to leave DFAT in numbers. And DFAT confirms that in the 6 months following the merger, it lost 45 local staff. Rivan says it's a sign of how disenfranchised the local staff felt.
What was happening among the staff at that time?
There's definitely a sense of insult. A lot of the Indonesian staff simply felt that they were not just insulted. There's a sense of betrayal, I guess. And we're talking about people who had worked with AusAid for 10, 15 years.
But Rivan says he understands why DFAT needs to work differently from AusAid.
If you go with the logic of a Department of Foreign Affairs, then this makes perfect sense. You cannot trust confidential and security-related issues to non-Australians. It doesn't make sense when that logic is imposed on a development agency.
It sounds as though the problem is not that DFAT has that approach. The problem is that DFAT is now the key agency delivering aid.
Yes.
Rivan decided to leave DFAT too, and he's now studying a master's degree in the US. Reflecting on the problems at DFAT, Rivan says his main concern is that the good work AusAid had done in Jakarta and around Indonesia will now be lost.
The Indonesian government grew very used to working with the local staff in AusAid. It became the norm that it's not always some white person coming from Australia they would interface with.
Rivan is not the only person to raise these concerns. Several of Australia's top aid experts have spoken out about the impact of DFAT losing so many skilled staff. But the government itself has had little to say in response. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop did not respond to a request for interview for this program. And DFAT says only that staff turnover is expected during times of change and that it will hire new local staff to fill the gaps. So if former AusAid staff feel insulted and betrayed, and local workers across the aid and development sector believe they're treated unfairly, what does this mean for the aid projects themselves? Professor Carr says the effect inside the workplace needs to be acknowledged.
I mean, if you accept that teamwork is essential for international projects, how can you have teamwork when one side of the team is feeling that they're being really hard done by it? Not telling the other because of the power relationship, the other's not getting that it's happening. That's a recipe for failed teamwork.
And Franz believes that valuing local staff will help to improve the outcomes for projects.
International organizations, they need to change this policy. Try to make their organization a best place to treat someone fair, no matter he's expatriate or he's local. If they can do that, they will get a good staff with, you know, perfect capacity.
Professor Carr thinks organisations should consider setting limits around the wage gap.
You have inequality within countries, between countries, but you also have them inside organisations. You know, look at the debate that's been going on around CEO pay versus the shop floor and so on. You know, and some organisations are starting to introduce ceilings on that ratio. Well, I think our argument would be that maybe there needs to be a ceiling in the dual salary system too.
And Professor Carr says some organisations in the aid sector have begun to address the wage gap issue.
In our discussions in Papua New Guinea, we found that, you know, some of the organisations there were thinking the other way around. So they were thinking, well, we might not be able to make dollar matches on the salaries, but we could certainly offer, you know, schooling, help with fees for schools for local workers, and maybe some pension benefits. So, that, you know, there's room to be creative. It's not just about the money.
The Add Up project has undoubtedly helped to kickstart some activity around the wage gap. And Professor Carr says it's time to bring more organisations on board.
The challenge now is very political. You know, it's persuading organisations to take a gamble and make those changes. And it's socioeconomic because we have to demonstrate that it's worth their while to do so.
And picking up on the political challenge, in Indonesia, Franz believes the government has a role to play. Already, the Indonesian government has introduced laws that prevent expatriates from filling certain positions. And Franz says further changes to employment law could help to close the wage gap.
Some years ago, labour organisation here succeeded to push government to change employment law. So at the same thing also can be done by the government to make fairness in wage between expatriate and local staff.
With the future of the wage gap issue in mind, perhaps the last word should go to Vita in central Kalimantan. Vita wants her fellow Indonesians to push for their rights and to bring about change from within.
We should have the same right as people from outside, overseas. And if we understand that to the core, we could empower ourselves to stand on our feet. And I believe that. I believe that if we can take control, at least we can have a bargaining position. And that if more people have that, I think the system can change.